This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Welcome, everyone, to Metatrex, Trek FM's show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me is Zachary Frühling. In episode 32, we're going to be talking about our picks for essential Trek philosophy from Voyager Season 7. Well, Zachary, welcome to the program. How are you doing today?
I'm doing okay. You know, I'm really excited. Anyone who knows me knows that Voyager is my favorite Star Trek show. So I'm looking forward to just diving in and talking about Voyager Season 7. It's not my favorite season of Voyager, but, you know, any chance to talk about Voyager is okay by me.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about Voyager Season 7. As we were talking in the Turbo Lift, Voyager isn't necessarily my favorite iteration of Star Trek. Now, that's not to say that I dislike Voyager or anything like that. It's just not particularly my favorite Star Trek. So this is a little bit of a challenge. But what I really enjoy about doing these essential episodes, Zachary, is oftentimes when we do an episode of Metatrex in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group, we'll often get comments from listeners saying, well, what about this episode? Or you didn't mention that episode. And I love it that we're able to engage our listeners in ongoing discussion about Metatrex, but it's so difficult to really kind of cram every episode that's applicable into an episode of Metatrex. So this is an opportunity for us to kind of go back and pull an episode out of a particular season, in this case, Voyager Season 7, and we can maybe call back to a previous episode of Metatrex and talk about it in light of that particular episode. So I always have fun with these.
Well, I think for me, Voyager's my favorite Star Trek series, but it's not for the reasons you might think. I think Voyager maybe gets a little bit of a bad rap for being a little light on philosophy. You know, it's more lighthearted than Enterprise. It's more lighthearted than Deep Space Nine. You know, it generally has sort of a lighthearted, some sort of optimistic tone, whereas Deep Space Nine is known as being a little darker. But for me, it's just the sense of family on Voyager. You know, the Voyager crew is stuck in the Delta Quadrant, and they have to get back home. And, you know, it's not like they're fighting a grandiose war, although there's some interactions with the Borg. And, you know, there are definitely crises like Year of Hell. But there are punctuation marks in the run of Voyager. Generally, it's more of a lighthearted, you know, long journey home and all of the sort of lighthearted stories and character interactions and family moments you might expect. So I like the generally lighthearted you know, tone and emphasis on Voyager as a family without the heavy drama that you get in say, Deep Space Nine. That said, it does get kind of a bad rap for being a little light on philosophy. If you really dig into Voyager, you can find a lot of philosophical threads woven in. We're going to talk about some of them tonight. But it is a challenge trying to pull those threads out of Season 7 of Voyager. Of all the seasons of Voyager, Season 7 is probably my least favorite. Maybe Season 2 with an exception. But so I really had trouble picking you know, enough material for us to talk about today. There's a lot of action stories in Season 7 of Voyager, and you can definitely see the show starting to wind down, you know, and the writers and producers are, you know, their energies are being focused on Enterprise at that point. You know, new Star Trek series right around the corner. So Voyager's getting a little long in the tooth. That said, I did find some interesting, you know, material for us to talk about. You know, some in fact, the list I came up with is not the list I expected to come up with when I first sat down to try to think of a list of the top episodes of philosophy in season 7 of Voyager. But before we get started talking about that, Mike, do you have any just thoughts on Voyager as a whole or season 7 in particular?
Yeah, season 7 in particular, I don't think was as philosophically rich as season 6, but I will say that there are some really interesting episodes woven throughout the entire season. I think you're right. It was a little light. It was even lighter towards the end of this particular season. And so I think a lot of your philosophically rich stories tend to be earlier in the season rather than later. That's not, you know, completely the case, but I think you're going to find your better philosophically rich stories really hitting in earlier in the season. I think you're right as far as Voyager as a whole, maybe not being as philosophically rich as, say, Star Trek The Next Generation, but nevertheless, I think there were definitely some interesting stories throughout the 7 seasons of Voyager. I could sit here and call up a few from memory, but we want to focus on season 7, and we want to talk a little bit about how we do our essentials and a little bit about that. But before we do, Zachary, I do want to mention that we did receive a new rating and review. This one's actually been out there for a little while, but as I was perusing the iTunes store, I came across this one in the UK store. And this review comes from Captain DJB from the UK store. And Captain DJB gave us a 5-star rating. And Zachary, Captain DJB says, "Philosophy through the lens of Star Trek. What could be better? What could be better?" Fans of science fiction enjoy...
Well, it's not Leola, it's not Neelix's Leola Root Stew.
Indeed, it is not. He says, fans of science fiction enjoy pondering the questions of existence, and you'll find that here. Entertaining and friendly discussions on a variety of subjects, 50 years of Star Trek and millennia of philosophy go hand in hand, and both hosts explore this well. Well, Captain DJB, we want to thank you for that 5-star rating and that wonderful review of Metatrex. We thank you so much for listening. Zachary, you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think I just want to say thank you for that really nice review. You know, like the reviewer mentioned, Star Trek and philosophy go hand in hand, and I'm pleased. I'm just always happy. I'm thrilled that listeners kind of get what we're trying to do on Metatrex and enjoying the discussions we have and enjoying our deep dive into some of these deeper issues in Star Trek. You know, I always sort of thought in my mind that the right people are going to get what we're trying to do here on Metatrex. So every one of those reviews just confirms that we're doing something really unique that you can't find anywhere else, and having the discussions that I was really craving to have when we started talking about doing Metatrex together. And you know, when we first started doing Metatrex, Mike, there was no place to have discussions like this. This sort of deeper dive into some of the you know, the deep philosophical issues that thrill me as an academic philosopher. And so I'm just pleased, you know, listeners are enjoying it as much as we enjoy making it.
Absolutely. And Zachary, it's always important for our listeners to reach out and let us know when they leave us ratings or reviews, especially in the international stores. Do you want to explain a little bit about that very quickly before we dive into Voyager Season 7 Essentials?
Sure. The thing about the iTunes stores is that they're all separate from one another. There's the American store that our listeners in the United States are familiar with, but listeners in almost any other country have their own separate iTunes store, and they're not linked together in any way. So if you leave a rating and a review for us on an international store, a non-United States iTunes store, please just let us know you left a review so we make the effort to go out and find the review and we can read it on the podcast. We may not get a notification, may not see it for quite some time unless you let us know that you left one. So thank thanks for taking the time to leave that review. And if anyone else out there in the great big world outside the United States is listening and leaves us a review, please just let us know and we'll be sure to read it on the podcast.
Yes, and we always give our contact information at the bottom of the show, so stick around for that. It will let you know how you can reach out and chat with us. You can talk to us about Star Trek and philosophy, or let us know what you thought about a particular episode of MetaTreks. We'd love to hear from you. So, Zachary, Season 7, Star Trek Voyager, Philosophy Essentials. We do something a little bit interesting, I think, here for MetaTreks. This is the second one that we've done. You and I got together and decided that we should do a season-by-season breakdown of some of the philosophically rich episodes of each series. And we thought, you know, everybody counts from one up. We thought we would go backwards. And we started a few weeks ago with the fourth season of Enterprise. And here we are. We are going to do season 7 of Voyager. In a few weeks, we'll circle back around and do the 7th season of Deep Space Nine. I should mention that we haven't shared our lists, so we're going to be as surprised, I think, with the picks that we each have, as much as perhaps some of our listeners will be. And I want to throw this invitation out to our listeners under our show thread. When this comes out, we'll have a show thread in the Babel Conference. Go into the Babel Conference. That's B-A-B-E-L. That's our listeners-only discussion group. Find our show thread for this particular episode, Voyager Season 7 Essentials, and tell us what your picks are. We'd love to hear what particular episodes of Season 7 of Voyager resonate with you, why maybe you think that particular episode or episodes were philosophically rich. What were the themes that that resonated with you? What did you pull out of it that you thought was interesting? Let's keep the discussion going.
Like I said, Mike, at the beginning of the show, I actually struggled with this a little bit because in season 7, even though it's a little light on philosophy compared to the other seasons of Voyager and definitely compared to other series in Star Trek, I had a hard time because a great many of my favorite episodes from season 7 didn't make my list of essential Trek philosophy. And some episodes that I don't normally rewatch when I do a rewatch, you know, episodes I tend to skip through, did kind of make my list.
Oh.
So it'll be interesting to compare lists and see, where our philosophical intuitions lie with this season that was a little bit like pulling teeth philosophically.
Okay, so we have 5 essential picks, and I've got a couple of honorable mentions. I don't know what you've got there.
I have no honorable
mentions.
You have
no honorable
mentions.
Okay,
I have none.
I've got 5 picks and 2 honorable mentions. So okay. Do you want to kick us off?
Why not? So the first one I have on my list is the episode Critical Care, episode 5 from season 7.
Okay.
And the reason I like this episode, and this is actually a good example, this is not one of my favorite episodes of Voyager. In fact, I have a hard time kind of remembering that this episode even exists, frankly. In my headcanon, this episode is just not a spectacular episode. It's not one of my favorites for a number of reasons. But it really explores some interesting ideas. The notion of in this sort of hospital facility, the notion that different people are assigned different statuses, that some people have priority over others, to the extent to which even a low priority preventative, you know, care for one class of people can outweigh an emergency critical care for a lower status of people. So in season 7 and Voyager in general, I think you can see some examples of some exploration of the idea of different classes of society or different types of beings. And you see this with the doctor in several episodes, you know, whether the doctor is classified as a person with rights and whatnot. And so that's going on at the same time in season 7. But this episode really dives into the fact that can we really quantify the value that different people have to society and provide them different levels of medical care and treat them differently. And I don't think any of us watches an episode like that and thinks that's a world I want to live in, where people are assigned, a different status and aren't provided that equitable treatment that we come to expect in a democratic, free kind of society. So I like that the episode just provides an example of what the world would be like if you really take that utilitarian idea of trying to maximize the benefit for the greatest number of people and provide gradations of different types of value for different kinds of individuals and make it very quantitative. I think the end result is not necessarily the kind of the good positive world that the proponents of utilitarian theory thought that would result in.
Yeah, I think we're off to a great start because this was actually number five on my list. So you and I are in some agreement here. I do think that this was an interesting exploration of medical ethics. It's almost a prophetic look at the course of modern medical care. I know systems like this are in place in some countries now around the world where medical care is rationed out to some degree in whether you want to call it a classification system or not. I've got a friend that has spent some time in Europe, and you know, it is to some degree a classification system in some areas of Europe. So there's almost a prophetic nature to this particular episode, and it seems to me like we're dealing with consequentialism, deontological ethics. I'm thinking that we talked a little bit about, not this particular episode, but, you know, these ideas in episode 6 of Metatrek's episode entitled Whacking Vrenak, where we explored the ideas of consequentialism versus deontological or rules-based ethics. So it seems to me that, you know, this particular society in critical care, they've got rules, and you know, the doctor finds himself in this really interesting kind of medical ethics dilemma because his programming is such that he finds it necessary to provide the very best care to anybody, regardless of their classification or status in society. And so he has to get creative in order to, in order to make sure that everyone receives quality medical care.
I like at the end of the episode, Seven basically tells the doctor that it's okay to sacrifice one person to save many. She just gives a straight up consequentialist reading of the entire situation. And like you said, that doesn't sit well with the doctor's programming, which kind of by definition is going to be rule based, right? You know, what are the standards that are involved in medical care? And you sort of program in the rules, right? Whatever algorithms are behind the doctor's program, you know, someone had to say, you know, Dr. Lewis Zimmerman had to say, you know, here's the rules that you follow. And you know, the ethics of medical treatment. And, you know, that kind of quantitative analysis doesn't sit well with the doctor's rule-based medical programming, I would say.
Yeah, and I think ethically speaking, I think probably most people who are going to watch this episode are going to sympathize to some degree with the doctor. But the thing that I find interesting is you're absolutely right. The doctor has a certain set of rules in his programming. And here he is in a society in which the rules are 180 degrees in the opposite direction of what his intuitions are based on his programming. And so how does he respond to that? Does he conform or does he rebel? And the doctor chooses to rebel. And I think that's probably going to be the intuition of most Star Trek fans, at least in terms of this episode, but I think it raises some interesting questions there about conformity, you know, in the face of a society in which the rules don't necessarily line up with our own sense of morals and ethics.
You know, I think what else fascinates me about this episode is just remembering the time frame that this episode was created in, you know, the late 1990s. Mm-hmm. And in the late 90s into the early 2000s, in the later seasons of Voyager and in the early seasons of, well, all throughout Enterprise, really, the early 2000s, you get there's a lot of exploration of medical ethics and bioethics, and that's, you just have to remember back, you know, a lot of this was really new territory at mm-hmm. a certain point, right? Bioengineering, medical advances, maybe even the quantitative approach to medicine with insurance companies, you know, doing more and more data analysis on people. And, you know, this is a really kind of subtle commentary on the state of affairs. And I think you're right. You mentioned that like in Europe, there's more of a system that's kind of like this, and maybe a categorization system. But even here in the United States, you know, we have insurance companies. Without a doubt, each one of us is put in our own category. Sure. by our insurance companies, right? With a risk analysis associated with mm-hmm. it, and how much money they're willing to spend, what kind of risk they're willing to take, how much a premium should cost. And we're already categorized in this way, and we just don't think about it because we just think we get our paychecks and we pay our insurance, and we forget that behind the scenes there are people kind of pulling the strings who are doing this kind of value judgment on the sort of risk benefit value analysis of their customers, you know, medical practitioners and or you know, insurance companies. So this is really an interesting commentary on that quantitative business approach to ethics, as opposed to a more of a maybe a socialist or more of a government provided healthcare approach. You know, this could be read as commentary on that business approach to medicine.
Yeah, I agree completely. I actually work in healthcare, and I see this happen all the time, where a doctor and patient agree that a particular therapy is necessary. And so you go to the insurance company and you get what's called a pre-authorization. In other words, you present the doctor's findings and the patient's desire to the insurance company, and you are asking them to give you an authorization. Basically,
you're saying you ask the hierarchy?
You ask the hierarchy, and you wait for the answer. And the answer comes in the form of a pre-authorization number, which is basically supposed to be, although it not always is, their guarantee that they're going to pay. And so once you get that authorization from the insurance, you can then dispense whatever, you know, therapy equipment is necessary in order to treat the patient. And sometimes, Zachary, the insurance company determines, regardless of the physician's desire, the patient's desire, that they've determined that, no, this actually isn't under a particular set of rules or criteria. This particular therapy isn't medically necessary, and so they won't give an authorization. Or oftentimes they'll give you some type of pre-authorization, but then when you actually submit a bill, they will find a problem in the criteria and refuse payment. And so, you know, at that point in time, the patient ends up having to pay privately out of pocket, or they have to give up the equipment or therapy that they're receiving. It's tragic, but it's true that it's somebody besides the doctor and the patient making these decisions. It's actually, you know, somebody that's crunching numbers, pulling strings, oftentimes at an insurance company. Call it the hierarchy, or, you know, whatever you want to call it. It is what it is.
You know, regardless of your political views on medical care and medical ethics in general, there's something about that situation that should sit a little uneasy with almost everyone. Because I think we have this sort of good Samaritan intuition that if you have the ability to help someone, you have the means, you have the tools, you have the knowledge, and the person's sitting right in front of you, you have something of an obligation to help that person. And if there's barriers in the way, you know, quantitative or business or profit or risk or whatever the barriers are in the way, that's just strikes me as really it's at least tragic.
Indeed.
If it's not outright wrong, you know, if it's interfering with the doctor's obligations towards a patient. And you can see the situation inside this episode of Voyager, critical care, you know, facing a very similar situation.
Yeah, absolutely. So Zachary, on my list, that was actually number five on my list. My number one,
right,
on my
check
list,
that one off. Okay.
And I'm going to go all the way back to the beginning of the season, Unimatrix Zero. And I realized that this was actually the second part of a two-part episode. It was the season six finale, and we're coming into season seven. The very first episode
was
the wrap
cheating.
Up to that. What's that? Is that cheating?
That's cheating. That's like picking up the tail end of season six. We're talking season seven.
This is season seven.
What season did you watch?
I watched them all. But you know what gets me about Unimatrix Zero, and Zachary, hopefully you'll agree with me. I think this is straight up Plato's Cave. What do you think?
His brain is gone.
Oh, sorry, you threw me for a loop. I did. You know, it's interesting that you say that, Mike, because that's something that it sounds so obvious when you say it, but it's not something that came immediately to mind when I rewatched season 7. Why don't you say a few words about what you had in mind there?
Well, you know, in episode 10 of Metatrix, there's always a glitch. We talked about, you know, reality and the nature of reality. And so as I'm watching this, it occurs to me that Unimatrix Zero becomes a place in which these Borg drones are able to exist in almost a cave of shadows while their actual or perceived actual existence, you know, continues to go on. They're in a state of sleep, and so they kind of go into this make-believe place where they assume their previous identities and they live their lives and they form relationships. But at the end of the day, you're asking the question, is it really real?
Well, see, it's interesting that you say that. I think maybe this was the reason I didn't make that connection right off the bat, because in a way, being inside this illusion, where they get to be more authentically themselves, their old identities, mm-hmm. right? They get to cease being a Borg for a while and actually function as individuals again. In a way, that's more authentic. You know, there's the problem of the external world. You know, yes. How do you know that the things you're perceiving are actually real? So in that sense, I'm picking up on the allegory of the cave and even some Cartesian skepticism. But there's a sense in which being inside that illusion allows these individuals to be even more authentically themselves. And, you know, if you sort of prioritize the internal mental lives of these individuals, something like Descartes would do, you know, you are your self-identity, your mind, right? It, regardless of what's going on in the external world and whether you know that's real or not, this illusion lets these people be themselves for the first time in a while. So there is this problem of the external world, but it also frees them up in an interesting way that is almost counter to Plato's allegory of the cave.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. The thing that I find fascinating about this is that they did try to leverage this experience and use it to alter what was going on in the external world. I found that very interesting that they would try to tap in and use this in order to alter reality, to almost take Unimatrix Zero and bring it into the real world.
And I love that in the 80s and 90s, you know, we're on the tail end of that in the 90s here in season 7 of Voyager. But I love that as technology improves, as it gets more and more sophisticated and the illusions that we can create get more and more realistic, you know, it just raises these kinds of stories all over again. Every time there's an improvement in technology, you have to ask this question all over again. What is the line between the illusion and reality? Can you even make that distinction? If you're able to affect reality with the illusion, isn't that just as good as being real? I mean, isn't there, you can't draw a sort of a sharp dividing line between the illusion and reality. And I think that, to me, that speaks to some interesting postmodern philosophy, like Jean Baudrillard, the French critical theorist. You know, just this idea that as we get an increasingly global technological society, the lines between what's real and what's not get blurred where you can't just easily write something off as fiction or an illusion because it has real world import.
Yeah, indeed. From a story aspect, I really appreciated the opportunity that they gave to Seven of Nine to explore Annika Hansen and to connect with her true self. But again, I have to kind of call back to, you know, just this being straight up Plato's cave, but you're absolutely right. It's almost a counter idea. It's almost writing Plato's cave backwards, in which the cave is real and the external world is the illusion.
Yeah, in that sense, it's a really interesting inversion of Plato's allegory of the cave. I think the thing that people find interesting about the allegory of the cave is generally this idea that maybe the stuff that we see around us, the judgments we make and the ideas we have and our, you know, views about what's real and what's not, or true or not, or politically worthwhile or not. All of that might be merely illusory, and there's some higher level of a reality. For Plato, it's these abstract forms, right? Justice in itself, and truth in itself, right, and beauty in itself. But this idea that this world, this day-to-day world, is not the most fundamental level of reality. But this is an interesting inversion, yes, because, you know, the illusion here brings reality to life and restores the individuality for these people. So I'd be curious to think what Plato would say, you know, if the illusion allows you to be that authentic version of yourself, you know, why isn't the illusion to be preferred? And of course, he would just say that, you know, you're really in the cave if you're trying to argue that the shadows are more real than the light that generates the shadows, right? But I think in this sense, it's really true. And I can't speak to whether that was an intention of the writer of the episode, but you know, insofar as it's a cave allegory, it's an interesting twist on it, or an inversion of it.
Yeah, you mentioned the writer of the episode. That being Brandon Braga, I believe. I think that probably goes under his...
Well, we've said it many times. Brandon Braga's weird stuff.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I think we have...
This is definitely a Brandon Braga's weird stuff episode. You know? I didn't take the time to look it up, but that doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. So Unimatrix Zero, was it on your list anywhere?
It wasn't, actually. So that's one just for
okay.
you.
Okay. All right. So what else do you have on your list?
Okay, these are in no particular order. So my next episode is Lineage.
Oh, excellent.
Is that on your list?
It was one of my honorable mentions.
Okay. So Lineage, for me, this episode is interesting because, it's amazing how much of these episodes were in season 7 of Voyager. And also, we found this to be true last time when we did an Essential Trek Philosophy episode on season 4 of Enterprise, how much the sort of medical ethics and bioethics is really packed into these later seasons of Star Trek in the 90s and early 2000s. So in this episode, we get some interesting exploration of the ethics of genetic engineering. Mm-hmm. And it raises some really disturbing issues in a really friendly, low-stakes, Star Trek-y, optimistic kind of way. But if you really take the time to dive into the issues involved, these are scary, scary issues. The notion of a designer baby, that you can go in and tweak a baby's DNA and change the phenomenal the phenotypes that result, right? The you know, facial features, getting rid of B'Elanna and Tom's baby's facial ridges. You know, they're basically what's interesting to me, I think, is the inversion of it. This harkens right back to, like, you know, like Nazi Germany, right? You know, Nazis wanting, you know, blonde haired, blue eyed, good German babies. Mm-hmm. Right? And so this is a really scary concept. And what's interesting to me, I think, you know, now we look at that and we go, oh my God, that's we don't want that in the world. That's a terrible way to be, right? That is wrong on so many levels. But here's an interesting case where the parents themselves, you know, B'Elanna in particular, not the parents, but B'Elanna, you know, wants to go in and sort of design her own baby. It's not like someone is foisting her to do this. It's not like the government from on high is saying, you know, we're going to genetically alter your baby so you can be part of the perfect race or anything like that. But this is an interesting sort of psychological reading of it, where B'Elanna has convinced herself that it's bad to have the experiences that she had. And she wants to, maybe rightly so, maybe, you know, she wants to, you know, spare the you know, her child the same kind of experience that she had, that she found traumatic. But you know, she's kind of seeking out this thing that the rest of us are going, oh my God, that's a terrible sort of eugenics, genetic engineering, you know, Nazi Germany way of doing things. We don't do that.
Yeah.
And so I like the inversion of it. I like that there's this really sort of terrible, you know, way of approaching genetic engineering that B'Elanna herself is seeking out for some psychological reason.
You know, it's funny. I'm starting to think you and I have spent way too much time together. What you said after you announced that Lineage was on your list, almost word for word, matches what I have written down here in my notes. I said that this was an interesting exploration of the ethics surrounding genetic, and the only word that you and I differed was I called it manipulation. And I think ditto to everything you said, and I think that's all what makes this such a good episode. I think there is no doubt whatsoever that B'Elanna's intentions are good.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, her intentions are good. She wants the best possible outcome, but again, we're raising questions about the ethics of manipulating genetics in order to achieve that good. And what I find interesting, at least in the Star Trek universe, is here we are, a couple hundred years after the eugenics wars, and we're still, we're still having these issues. We explored this a little bit in Deep Space Nine, and here we get to explore it a little bit in Voyager. This goes way beyond, the Doctor trying to correct some type of physical problem. If memory serves, I think there was a small curvature of the spine. Doctor said, no problem, I can fix it. I can tweak a gene here, and I can, and it's all good. And how that kind of birthed in the mind of B'Elanna, if I want to, I can tweak a gene here, and I can change this, and no forehead, blonde blue eyes, looks just like Tom, and we're good to go. All for the right reasons. And it just falls into the category of trying to do the wrong thing for all the right reasons. I thought it was really fascinating and very timely, because again, pointing back to what you said earlier, you think about the time in which this episode was written, we were really dealing with these kinds of questions in the real world. Now that we've kind of unlocked the genetic code, how far do we take this?
I think what I like about this episode is the way it plays with the contrast between normal and abnormal. A lot of good is done in the name of correcting abnormalities, right? There's an abnormal curvature of the spine. Yes. So sure, the doctor can go in and do some genetic manipulation and correct that abnormality and make the baby normal again, right? And a lot of medical, good medical practice is like that. There's a sort of proper function to certain features of the human body, or alien body in this case. If there's an abnormality, it's good and right to try to correct that and bring that in line. So there's this kind of proper function. And to me, there's this philosopher and theologian named Alvin Plantinga. Are you familiar with,
no,
with Plantinga?
No.
Well, he had this idea. One of his books is called Warrant and Proper Function. He had this idea that when our mental faculties are working kind of as intended, as they were designed in normal practice, and by normal he means in a sort of biological way, that will produce certain states of knowledge. So it's this kind of really interesting biological read of what it means to acquire knowledge. But a lot of it hinges on this idea of proper functioning, that there's a proper way that certain features of our biology are supposed to function that results in a sort of proper functioning of the mind, and that results in certain states of knowledge. And something like that is going on here, right? There's a certain way that the spine is supposed to function, and if there's a mistake there, you can go in and you can correct it and bring that back in line with normalcy. But what's interesting about this episode is the way it plays with this dangerous sense of normalcy, mm-hmm. right? If you have, like, for example, I keep going back to Nazis, and we get lots of Nazis in Star Trek too. So I have no problem invoking Nazis when we're talking about Star Trek and philosophy. But Nazis, if they came along and say it's normal for people to be blonde-haired and blue-eyed, and anything that's not blonde-haired and blue-eyed is not normal. It's abnormal. Mm-hmm. It's defective in some way. You start to get this really negative ethical reading of certain things that are just plain normal, right? So it's not obvious at all. Yes, most people don't have a curved spine in a certain way. There's a curvature of the spine. It's abnormal, but what makes it sort of worthy of correction? Who's to say it's not a new evolutionary trait? Who's to say it's not something that's just a quirk of this baby, right? So there is this kind of ethical issue of even defining what normal is in the first place. I don't think that's obvious at all, given the diversity of different kinds of features you get amongst people who are, again, using irony quotes now, normal, right? But here, if you start to define certain traits as being desirable, the danger of saying certain traits are normal is that those traits become desirable. And anyone who doesn't fall in line with that normalcy is something to be weeded out. And here we can see B'Elanna trying to do that with her own child, which is tragic in itself. But if society does that, starts to define certain things as normal and anything else as being abnormal, that can lead to really terrible things like eugenics and racial cleansing and these really terrible ethical ideas. But it all kind of hinges on this idea that certain things are normal/desirable and anything else is not.
Yeah, exactly. I think one of the things that makes this such a good episode, we mentioned the writer on Unimatrix Zero, James Caan is the writer, and he wrote a few episodes in season 7 of Voyager. James Caan probably, as far as his writing goes, probably most notably was the writer who gave us the novelization of Star Wars Return of the Jedi. But what a lot of people don't realize is that James Caan was actually a medical specialist. He did his postgraduate work specializing in emergency medicine at UCLA. So I think he really brought an interesting perspective to this particular story. And again, in 2001, this was a hot button kind of issue, and we were exploring the ethics of you know, how far do we take genetic manipulation. And I think he did an incredible job exploring that in the realm of science fiction through the lens of Star Trek.
And I just love that this is what Star Trek is good at. You can take a really hot button issue. In fact, there's this whole phrase, designer babies, right? That was used at the time period. And I don't know if that phrase is still really used by, you know, people who are having these discussions, but, you know, this was a hot button issue. And, you know, and if you, and in the late 20th century, you know, people are, you know, there are more of them alive then than there are now, but there are people who went through, survived the Holocaust, mm-hmm. and were trying to be weeded out of the world, you know, their relatives and family slaughtered. And, you know, if you live that experience, this is a real life issue. This isn't something that's abstract for a lot of people. But Star Trek's ability to take a very hot button issue that's very sensitive for a lot of people and putting it in a science fiction context that lets you kind of step back from the emotions of it and look at it, you know, a little more rationally and draw your intuitions different ways. You know, this is a great example of how Star Trek, you know, I mean, in fiction in general, but Star Trek in particular, can be used to kind of pull your philosophical intuitions and let you entertain ideas that you may not necessarily entertain otherwise. And I just love that this episode juxtaposes the pros and the cons, the good side and the bad side of our increasing ability to do things like genetic manipulation, genetic engineering. You know, we can solve problems, but we can also create designer babies, and we can weed certain people out if we're not careful. And, you know, there's this ethical component that if you're not paying attention to, you can let the science kind of run away with itself unchecked and lead to the kind of world we don't want to live in.
Indeed, it's a great objective look for sure. All right, so number two on my list, Zachary, is the episode Repentance, which Lucky 13 actually comes right after the episode we just discussed, Lineage. This episode dealt with the death penalty. It was a death penalty morality play. It explored the question, can a person really change? It explored the ethics of state-sanctioned executions, again, all through the lens of Star Trek.
Yeah, this was on my list as well, so we just checked one off my list too. I like this episode because it really explores this issue of crime and punishment in a number of different ways, all in the same story. I like that it entertains the idea that crime is a neurological or a mental disorder. You know, the ability to affect someone's personality with Borg nanoprobes opens up an interesting line of research for how to deal with problems in society. You know, can we treat this neurologically and solve society's problems in that way? And it also, you know, raises all the issues that you mentioned. I like that it also explores the idea of stereotyping. You know, the I can't remember his name, unfortunately, the prisoner,
Ica?
The one who said he was stereotyped by, you know, just by being part of a certain category of people, people mm-hmm. just assume that he's guilty. So it's also exploring this idea of, you know, stereotyping by police or by investigators, just assuming people's guilt because the wrong, you know, color of person or the wrong type of person is in the wrong kind of environment at the wrong time, that can lead to someone being wrongfully incarcerated. And of course, by the end of it, you realize, okay, wait, this guy is has real problems after all. He's not as sympathetic of a character as he's played through most of the episode. But it does explore the idea of stereotyping, explores the ethics of punishment, explores this idea of, you know, maybe letting the victim's family choose the punishment. That's an interesting theory of punishment.
That is.
Explores the idea of crime as a mental disorder. It packs a lot of interesting nuances to this discussion into a single episode.
And Zachary, I should mention that we just had an exploration of our own of crime and punishment in episode 29 of Metatreks. That episode was entitled Punishment Protocol 9. We actually looked at this, I think, in a pretty full way. So if our listeners want to go back and listen to that episode in light of this season 7, episode 13 episode of Voyager, I think you're exactly right. You know, Iko, I think that's how it's pronounced. Iko, at first was a much more sympathetic character, I think, than what he was at the end of the episode. But still, at the end of the episode, you can't help but feel for him. And, you know, Warden Yedick, I think was his name, you know, he was warning everybody, you know, not to buy into it. And it's funny because I've seen that kind of jaded, non-objective attitude when it comes to people who have committed crime. And I won't get back into what we discussed on episode 29, Punishment Protocol 9, but
I'm sorry, Mike. That's Punishment Protocol 9
Alpha. 9 Alpha.
You better get that right, or 7 of 9 is going to make you go stand in the corner. Do your homework.
Do my homework. Oh, that's funny. But yeah, you know, very, very non-objective, jaded to some degree. And he warns everybody not to play into, you know, Iko's kind of sympathetic play about how he's changed and he's been typecast and you know, it's a case of discrimination.
Well, it's interesting because oftentimes, and this is the situation, I think, that the entire legal process, you know, this is the situation that process faces all the time, that, you know, when you have a defendant who's committed a crime, you're going to hear every possible angle, right? Is this a criminal who's done, you know, willfully done some bad things, or is this a victim of stereotyping or circumstance or experience or whatever the story is? And you have to weigh these two together. And there's no obvious way of knowing which it is. Sometimes it's going to be one and sometimes it's going to be the other. And, you know, the idea is that eventually the truth will reveal itself. But at first glance, it's not, you know, some of those stories are going to be true and some of them aren't. You don't know which story is like that. The poor me, I'm a victim. I deserve sympathy. I was treated unfairly. Sometimes that's going to be genuine and sometimes it's not. And you just have no way of knowing which it is. You know, and eventually the truth gets revealed, you know, towards the end of this episode. But I think the entire legal system suffers from that problem, the adversarial approach to justice. The idea that, you know, there's going to be a prosecutor who's got evidence against you, and there's going to be a defense that's going to try to tell another interpretation of that same evidence, you know, invoking whatever is necessary to provide an adequate defense. That is, it creates an interesting conundrum for whoever, in our system, it's the jury. Of course, the jury is the one who has to sort through all of that and decide what's true or not. But the idea is that in telling those different stories and looking at the evidence in different ways, hopefully the truth comes to light and irrational people can adjudicate one reading from the other and decide which is the right interpretation.
There's a really strong line in this episode that stands out to me. And Catherine Janeway says to Warden Yedick, you know, how do you justify beating a defenseless man? And the warden says, violence is the only thing he understands. Of course, Janeway fires back, you seem to have a pretty good grasp of that yourself. But, you know, that raises a really interesting question. I think it's very timely, and I think it fits into some of the debate that's going on today and the current events of the time. You know, how do you deal with you know, the ongoing violence that we see cropping up in our world? And again, not to get into a political discussion, you know, in this country, it seems to hover around, you know, guns or no guns. In the world, you know, do we answer extremism with firepower, or do we seek some type of diplomatic answer? And so, In light of those kind of ongoing debates that we seem to be having in our world today, I find this episode really an interesting exploration of some of those issues as well, because this particular man, Iko, was, at least in terms of what we see on the screen, was being mistreated. And certainly Captain Janeway felt that he was being mistreated. But the answer was, well, this is violence is the only thing that he's going to understand. And Zachary, it occurs to me that we are saying some of those same things today in response to some of the calamity that we see going on in our own world.
Yeah, I think that's just another variation on that problem I was just mentioning, the problem of trying to decide, you know, which story to believe. Do you believe the sympathetic story, or do you believe the sort of willful, intentional criminal story, right? You know, you have two competing stories, and it's not obvious at all which is which. I think in terms of world affairs like that, I think you have an interesting dilemma where sometimes you can look at problems in the world and you should feel sorry for it, and you should be emotionally swayed by your sympathy for everything that's wrong in the world. And then other times, if you do that path too much, you're going to allow yourself to be victimized, or you're going to allow yourself to be have violence done against you or your country, right? So the balance between being willing to use violence and strength and force appropriately when it's necessary, and yet also not being so jaded or so willing to use that violence or use that might that you're not, you know, that you don't feel the sympathy when sympathy is called for. It's almost like this Aristotelian middle ground, you know, between these two opposing extremes. You know, a lot of the discussion seems to hinge on the extremes, right? Total pacifism versus total militarism, mm-hmm. right? And reality is probably somewhere in the middle. There's a lot of things in the world to be sorry for. There's people who do bad things in the world you should feel sorry for because people are dysfunctional in some way. There's something that's gone wrong either in their experience or in their mental state or their worldview or whatnot. And, that's something to feel sorry for. On the other hand, you know, if there's a clear and present danger, if someone's going to do harm, you have to be willing to step to the plate and use force when necessary. And every Star Trek series has to deal with this a little bit, right? When force finds you, you know, what do you do about it? Well, you carry a big photon torpedo tube, right? Janeway's not afraid to use photon torpedoes. Sisko's not afraid to use photon torpedoes, right? This is something that Star Trek deals with a lot. You know, when trouble finds you, you need to carry a big sure. stick, but you shouldn't go out looking for trouble with that big stick. And in my mind, it's just a plain, straight up Aristotelian middle ground. You know, you don't want to be too violent and too ready to use violence. You don't want to be so much of a pacifist that you let people do harm to you, or you're not willing to protect your family or your friends or your country or your whatever. And if you err too much on either side, then you're going to create a problem.
On the front of capital punishment, I thought this episode did an excellent job remaining objective. In fact, there's a conversation that takes place between Seven of Nine and the Doctor, and the Doctor says to Seven of Nine, you know, I'm really surprised you're not having, you know, trouble with this really barbaric system. And Seven of Nine says, well, you know, you've encouraged me to try to look at both sides of the argument. I'm trying to be objective here. And the Doctor says something very interesting. He says, well, this, this occasion when my programming won't allow me to be objective, he says, killing is wrong no matter who's doing it. And again, I think that they did a really good job exploring really objectively both sides of the argument for or against capital punishment.
It's amazing how many times these discussions kind of hinge on this distinction between consequentialism and rule-based mm-hmm. ethics. And we keep coming back to that because that's a persistent theme yes. in all of these discussions, right? On the one hand, if you're willing to, you know, defend yourself, use violence in certain contexts, that's a consequentialist approach because you're willing to do certain things for the sake of a better outcome, right? That's just, you know, some variety of a consequentialist approach. On the other hand, this view that killing is always wrong, no matter who's doing it, no matter what the context is, that is something very much like Immanuel Kant would say in a rule-based deontological ethics. And, you know, again and again, you know, these ethical issues seem to boil down to to that kind of discussion. But what's interesting is this sort of personal touch that Janeway puts on it. Mm-hmm. You know, Janeway says, you know, you seem like you've been willing to learn violence yourself, and you seem pretty familiar with that approach yourself. Mm-hmm. Of course, Janeway would just pour hot coffee on you, right?
Oops.
So, you know, don't push Janeway too far. You're going to end up with hot coffee in your face.
Hey, she did beat the board with it, so.
Exactly. One borg at a time. But, you know, a lot of times, you know, I guess it's not obvious at all which approach to take. You know, you can take this consequentialist approach, you know, what should we do to maximize good consequences? You can go rule-based ethics on it, and you can say, well, killing's always wrong. But then there's the sort of third option, the virtue ethics approach. You know, what kind of personality traits do we find desirable? What kind of people do we want to be? Do we want to be the kind of people that are willing to use violence at a moment's notice? Do we want to be the kind of people that hide in a corner every time trouble finds us? Do we want to be the kind of people that find a middle ground? And that's not so much a question of, you know, which ethical theory is correct. It has to do with what kind of people we want to be. And I think there's a lot of interesting exploration of the relationship between the actions and the crimes that are done inside this episode and the violence, and how it's tied to personality traits and how malleable those personal traits are in this technological world that Star Trek presents. So, you know, that's the third option, is just, you know, not asking, you know, in what way is violence appropriate to lead to better consequences, not what rules should we adopt, but what kind of people do we want to be? You know, are we the kind of people that do certain kinds of actions, or do we refrain from doing certain kinds of actions? And it's a qualitatively different question than just asking which ethical, you know, theory or which actions or which use of violence is most appropriate objectively.
Yeah. I think we could probably talk more about repentance. It was, again, on both of our lists, but we are rolling up on an hour here. So that was, again, on both our lists. So I believe the ball's in your court. You want to take a shot?
Yeah, again, these are in no particular order. I'm going to save my favorite for last, I think. But the next on my list, so I already checked off critical care and lineage and repentance. Workforce, a two-part episode, 16 and 17. And this is not the deepest philosophical issue or episode in Voyager. It's not even one of my favorite episodes. In fact, I have a hard time watching Workforce. I know people either love or hate this episode. I know Char and Tristan over on To the Journey have had a few discussions about Workforce and whether you should love or hate this episode. I tend to be in the dislike category. I don't actually care for this episode very much, but I like it because it raises this question of Cartesian skepticism that we mentioned earlier. This idea that, you know, in this episode, you know, the crew of Voyager, they're stuck on this planet, and they've kind of had their memories erased, and they're living on this planet, working for this organization down on the planet. They don't remember their lives on Voyager. They've had their memories altered. And it's an interesting situation that any one of us could ask any particular day. Every day I wake up and I have some breakfast and I go to work. I do the things I do, and I do the things in the evening that I do. And it just seems perfectly normal to me, right? It doesn't stand out in any way. It's just an ordinary work day. And this episode really plays that idea. You know, a normal work day could be absolutely an illusion. There could be, for all I know, my memories have been altered and I have a real life that's somewhere else. Maybe I'm from a starship somewhere. You know, it sounds wildly implausible, but in this episode, this kind of Cartesian line of reasoning, how do you really know that your experience is accurate? How do you know you're not being deceived from outside? How do you know your memories are accurate? You know, these kinds of things that sound really implausible when Descartes says them. How do I know that I'm not being deceived by an evil deceiver? How do I know that, you know, when I perceive something, that my mind isn't playing a trick on me and convincing me that it's true and actually it's false? This episode really brings that Cartesian skepticism, that ultra skeptical line of reasoning, into the level of the ordinary. These ordinary experiences that seem perfectly normal are totally exceptional and not accurate at all. They're not based in reality, but they seem perfectly normal from the first person standpoint to any one of the crew members stuck in this situation.
Yeah, and Star Trek tends to do this a lot, I think, kind of explore that idea. And again, this is just this particular episode wasn't on my list anywhere, but now that you mention it, it is, again, whether you're going through what seems to be a normal work day, or whether you're being hunted by Hirogen Nazis, you know, what's real and what's not. That's great. Again, it wasn't on my list, but Now that you mention it, it does kind of fall into that category.
Yeah, and the rest of the episode is actually a little unwatchable for me. I don't really enjoy the episode as a whole, but it is a fascinating... If you read Descartes' Meditations, when he starts to entertain these ideas, well, how do I know I'm not dreaming? Well, it sure seems like there's a qualitative difference between being awake and dreaming. You know, dreams are fleeting, and they're less vivid, and reality is more vivid. Okay, well, how do I know that my experiences aren't being... how do I know that I'm not insane? Well, he goes through some reasoning to try to explain how you can know you're not insane, that you're mentally sound. How do you know that, you know, when you do math, like 2 + 2 = 4, that your mind is reaching a correct conclusion instead of a conclusion that is erroneous, and you just convince yourself it's correct? And, you know, how do you know that just the veracity of your daily experience is there, that it's accurate? You know, I think anyone reading that for the first time goes, that's kind of, these are crazy ideas. I just know that my ordinary life is real, and that there's a real world out there. And, you know, there's other people in the world, and I interact with them. And we, you know, that all seems normal. And it all seems real. There's no reason to doubt any of it. And Descartes really tries to push that skeptical reasoning. And I just love that, you know, and oftentimes in Star Trek, it's done from the really extraordinary perspective. You're stuck in a holodeck, right? You know, this really... you know, technological science fiction-y kind of way of doing that. And in this episode, even though there's kind of a mental component, the memory component that's been altered, it's really in the ordinary. I love that it's called workforce too, because it's just such an ordinary, mm-hmm. you know, work a day kind of approach to this story, this way of telling the story. You know, these are crew members just going to work about their business, yeah. you know, interacting with their colleagues, and it all seems perfectly normal. It's not a holodeck. It's not a mind probe, you know, from outside. It's not a Vulcan mind meld. You know, there's none of that kind of going on. It's just an ordinary work day, and yet it's totally false. And you know, I think that's straight up Cartesian skepticism. You know, and I think that's the kind of, you know, the reliance on the ordinary experience to solve the problem of skepticism is what this episode pushes back against.
Yeah, yeah. This falls under the category of another lost love for poor Janeway. It's just, you know, just another, I think Janeway wishes for an ordinary life, because Janeway's life is not so ordinary, that's for sure.
Maybe that's why I don't like this episode. I'm team Janeway and Chakotay. I know not everyone is. I am. And maybe that's just, you know, it's like, no, you belong with Chakotay. What are you doing? What are you doing, Kathy?
In your best Q voice, I'm sure. She's just so sympathetic at the, you know, you just feel so bad for her.
Well, one of the things I like about this episode too is it does kind of raise, in an interesting way, it raises the issue of whether our personality traits are caused by nature or by nurture. Right, because here's an interesting case where all of the memories, all the experiences that define your real life have been bracketed away, right? So all the things that would define the way you were nurtured into your current being, those have been bracketed. And what that does is allow these sort of innate personality traits to show themselves. And I think what's interesting is each of these characters has some sort of innate personality trait that is masked a little bit by their experience of being in Starfleet. Captain Janeway's experiences as being captain of Voyager have defined who she is to some degree. And when you take that away, if those memories are gone and those experiences aren't a factor anymore, other parts of her personality start to come out. And then it's an interesting question about whether those are kind of the real Captain Janeway, right? Is this the real Catherine now that's not Captain Janeway that is coming out because, you know, the real version of herself has been masked to some degree? Or are these, you know, sort of fake memories, you know, the whatever fake memories are implanted that allow this alternate life to seem real, you know, with a backstory to it? Is that just another variety of the nurture component, the experience component defining who that Catherine Janeway is? And it's an interesting take on the nature nurture debate.
Yeah, and we got to explore that too in the B plot with Tom and B'Elanna as well, the nature of their relationship absolutely. I agree with you. I agree with you completely. Okay, so next on my list, I have Body and Soul. I love this episode for a lot of reasons. Even though the Doctor is more of a program, I thought that this was a really interesting take on the nature of consciousness, identity. You're dealing with metaphysics and just a lot of really cool stuff that they packed in this episode. And I thought, for the simple fact that you are dealing with the Doctor who's a program, and you are dealing with Seven of Nine, who, you know, is, you know, for all intents and purposes, Borg. I still think it was kind of an interesting play on that whole thing of taking the consciousness from one person and, you know, straight up putting it into another person.
And of course, you just get some of the best acting, you know. So,
anyone who says Jeri Ryan can't act should watch this episode, because she played the Doctor as well.
I think it's a real art to be playing yourself. It's really like playing three characters. There's the actress, you know, who's always present in any role, and then you've got you know, the character she's supposed to be playing, Seven of Nine, playing someone else. And it's a multi-layered performance. So, you know, whatever we think of the episode philosophically, you just have to give props to the acting in that episode.
Oh yeah, she pulled Bob Picardo's character off to a T. And again, Zachary, I just think it's a really interesting take on, you know, this idea that the nature of consciousness and identity and the whole metaphysical issue. Again, even though, and I know there's a part of me, the part of me that's really interested in philosophy wants to kind of push back a little bit and say, well, you're not really dealing with these things because, you know, the Doctor's a program. But I still think through the lens of Star Trek, it's kind of a fun exploration of those kind of ideas.
You know, it's not as spooky as the the way of dealing with consciousness that you see in the original series episode Return to Tomorrow, mm-hmm. where you have these disembodied aliens that are living inside these balls of light, and you know, you can swap consciousness, and it's not at all clear exactly how it works. You know, this version of that consciousness swapping or consciousness transference type of story is very technological. Right? The Doctor is a computer program, and he puts himself inside Seven's, you know, Borg technology, right? So definitely is this technological reading of the story. So it's not sort of spooky and metaphysical or even dualist, but it is interesting to sort of you know, think about insofar as the Doctor is a hologram, you have this ipso facto kind of raises the question of the Doctor's consciousness. What exactly accounts for the Doctor being present? You know, does his hollow emitters have to be on? In this case, no, right? The Doctor is inside Seven in some way. You know, what features of the Doctor's program give rise to consciousness, and how can that manifest itself, you know, when it's put in a different kind of physical system? So in my mind, there's all kinds of these sort of physicalist questions of emergence, like, you know, what exactly does the Doctor consist of? Is it the algorithms? Mm-hmm. Is he tied to a particular kind of physical system? You know, the hollow emitters and the computer back on Voyager. You know, how exactly does he remain consciousness when none of that is working and he's inside Seven instead? But insofar as the Doctor is just a piece of technology, you know, from a physicalist standpoint, how does that give rise to the Doctor as a conscious being?
Sure.
You know, given that he's in a different kind of physical system. So it's not as sort of spooky and metaphysical as other kinds of things you see in Star Trek, like Vulcan mind melds, you know, Spock transferring his Katra to McCoy. That makes far less sense to me than what you see in this episode.
Yeah, you mentioned Return to Tomorrow. I believe you were recently on the Ready Room discussing that episode.
Yeah, if you want to hear me talk about that episode of the original series, Return to Tomorrow, with C. Brian Jones, the founder of Trek FM, on our flagship show, The Ready Room, that's episode 201 of The Ready Room. The title is Escape from Lightball.
Yeah, indeed. And I should mention also, Zachary, that we tackled the nature of consciousness and its relation to the physical world in episode 13 of Metatrex, Spock's Pineal Gland.
Yeah, and again, it's interesting the different ways you can tell these kinds of consciousness stories, because I think science fiction kind of forces you to go one of two directions. Either you keep it straight up science fiction, where you try to give some sort of technological account of whatever weird experiences you're seeing in the story. In this case, there's technobabble that explains it away, right?
Technobabble and Voyager?
Yeah. There's a shocker, right? That's exactly right. How exactly does the Doctor get inside Seven? Oh, well, the thing transferred to the thing and we inject it. You know, exactly. Just straight up techno babble like you often get in Voyager. But, you know, it's not a spooky metaphysics. It's not fantasy. And other kinds of science fiction stories err on the side of fantasy. Mm-hmm. Like the Vulcan mind meld that's not... Yes, there's some sort of scientific thing that they totally hand, they don't even give techno babble, they just hand wave. Well, this is what Vulcans do, they're touch telepaths, yeah. Right? They don't really explain the mechanism. So in my mind, that's more like fantasy. The light ball thing that you see in Return to Tomorrow, you know, that kind of consciousness transference, this heavily dualist, heavily yes. metaphysical approach to consciousness is much more like fantasy. And I think the later iterations of Star Trek, as much as possible, try to stay grounded in the physical in some way without invoking the spooky metaphysics, if at all possible.
I always chuckle when you say spooky metaphysics.
Well, it's not spooky, not like spooky like Spooky Mulder in the X-Files, right? It's not like there's going to be, you know, aliens and zombies around every corner, but spooky in the sense of inexplicable, yes. Right? Just it's spooky in the sense that we can't explain it away, some ineffable, unexplainable feature of our experience. And you know, I think the Vulcan mind meld falls in that category, and I think the weird disembodied consciousnesses fall in that category. Like, what exactly is going on there? Doesn't look very scientific or mechanistic to me. But you know, the Doctor has a piece of technology inside Seven's technology, causing her to, you know, lose her own being still present and experiencing, but not really able to manifest herself in any way. That strikes me as a much more easy to explain away technologically, story than what I see in the more metaphysical versions of that. So yeah, spooky metaphysics, but not in the scary sense. Spooky in the sense of, you know, we don't really, no attempt to really explain what's going on, no mechanism, just, more closer to the fantasy camp.
Yeah. So Body and Soul was on my list, not on yours.
It was not on my list, no. As much as I love that episode, it didn't make the list. Probably for that reason. Probably because it doesn't necessarily... There's nothing deep to explain there to me. There is this mechanism,
sure.
like what is the Doctor and what accounts for him being real? But you know, the spooky metaphysics, you know, that there's a much more of a desire in me to really explain what is going on there. So consciousness itself is a little spooky because, you know, how exactly does the gray matter in our brain give rise to consciousness?
Right.
I mean, that's an interesting question. One of the hard, hard problems of philosophy, and one I keep coming back to, is deeply interesting. I just don't see that this episode addresses that sort of fundamental question for me, other than maybe this question of what exactly the Doctor consists of when he's, you know, if he's just an algorithm that has some emergent properties in a particular kind of system. Okay, I can understand that. He's an emergent property, and you know, consciousness emerges out of our brain, and consciousness right. emerges out of the Doctor's algorithms. I get that. But how exactly does that work when he's taken out of all that stuff and he still remains the Doctor?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not clear at all. But it's certainly grounded in the physical. He's still a computer program, and he's just running in a different kind of computer. So nothing's really changed. Nothing really needs explanation that hasn't already been explained in Voyager, as much as that's possible.
So I've got, Zachary, for you, I've got Critical Care, I have Lineage, I have Repentance for you, I have Workforce. That leaves you with just one episode to reveal.
Okay, this I have to give a caveat to my last pick.
Uh-oh.
Here. This is not the deepest philosophical episode, but I can't bring myself to not put this episode on my list no matter what. So I'm putting it on partly because it's got a little bit of philosophy in it, not very much, partly because it's one of my favorite episodes in season 7 of Voyager. So I don't care. It's going on my list. The episode is Shattered. Okay, that's, how can I put Shattered on my list?
That's on my list as well. Let's.
How can that be on your list? Okay, so Shattered, remember, is the episode where Voyager gets fragmented into different time periods. Things from the first season of Voyager. We get some Seska in there. We've got mm-hmm. you know, Voyager in the future. It's a fascinating idea. Again, it's sort of light on, it's an interesting idea, you know, it explores the idea of space and time. So there's this kind of physics component to it. How exactly does space-time work where it can be fragmented? Okay, that's not why it's on my list. It's interesting, though. It's on my list, I think, more for sort of existentialist responsibility reasons. I think in this episode, you get an interesting exploration of, you get to see Captain Janeway's reaction back in season one, you know, as kind of a flashback, we go back to the section of Voyager where Captain Janeway is in season one. She's just taken command of Voyager. She has yet to see what unfolds. She doesn't know she's going to get stuck in the Delta Quadrant, mm-hmm. and she gets a peek into her own future. You know, it's very much like, I'm sorry, what's the story? A Christmas Carol.
Yes.
Right? Where you can, if you get a glimpse into what your future would be like, if you follow a certain path, and do you want to be on that path or not? And Captain Janeway has to kind of confront this this reality that if she lets reality proceed as it was supposed to, if she lets Voyager get stranded in the Delta Quadrant, all these bad things are going to happen. All the things she's seeing around Voyager, and yet all these good things are going to happen. The crew becomes a family and mm-hmm. friendships and relationships, and you know, a next generation is born aboard Voyager. All this great stuff is going to happen. And Captain Janeway, you know, she's going to have to go back to her own time period and ask this question: should I let all that unfold? I have a peek into the future now. She has to really own the choice to strand Voyager, maybe in a way that she didn't even have to back in Caretaker.
Yeah.
And you know, I just like this existentialist responsibility component, that all of us are sort of radically responsible for whatever path we find ourselves on. And if you have what would you do if you had a peek into your own future? Would you sort of choose that as your destiny and embrace it? Or would you try to push back and run away from it and choose a different path? And every moment of every day is like that. You can be on a certain trajectory or you can go a different direction. We don't have the sort of clear glimpse into the future that Janeway gets here, but it really does kind of force the existential responsibility question. So that's kind of why I put it on the list philosophically, because, you know, if you had a glimpse into your future, or even different, if you could go back and revisit the past, right? You know, this is an interesting case where Chakotay gets a chance to go back and visit the past again and interact with, you know, younger versions of his colleagues and friends and revisit old experiences. Would that cause you to reflect on your life and the meaning of your life in a different, unique kind of way? And if you combine that with the ability to look into the future, what meaning would life have for you then? What choices would you make that you wouldn't make otherwise? And I guess my point is just that every moment of every day is like that. You have to take just this radical responsibility for your own reactions to what's happened in the past and what direction you want to be in the future. And if you can't take responsibility for that, then you're being sort of existentially dishonest. You're being, you know, life is forced upon you rather than owning your own choices. And we've observed before that the captains in Star Trek, regardless of which series, the captains are the most existential characters, because all the responsibility for their own lives and their own ships and the situations they encounter and the people under their command all rests just squarely on their shoulders. And this is a great example of Captain Janeway going, oh my God, if I follow this path, look at all these bad things that are going to happen that I'm going to be responsible for. How can I let that happen? And this is just another example of her feeling the weight of command, similar to as she does in the episode Night, I forget which season that is, but the episode Night, when she's starting to really feel the burden of having stranded her crew and feeling responsibility for it. You know, she's getting a taste of what's going to, you know, rest on her shoulders and her decisions as captain of Voyager. And all the captains are in that situation every day as well. I'm surprised Shattered was on your list, because I feel like it was kind of a stretch to put it on my list, but there you go. I hope I made something of it.
Well, it's funny, right here on my notes, I said, if you were, let me go back, in the turbo lift on the way to the bridge here, you and I were having a conversation and I asked you if you could go back and choose a different path in life when you were younger, what would you choose? And it's funny, because I had just put down my notes for this episode that we're doing right now, and for Shattered I wrote down in my notes, what would you choose if you could have a glimpse into your own future? So much for the same reason that it's on your list, it's on mine. Of course, I always love a good time travel episode that, you know, challenges the notion of multiple timelines and converging, you know, space and so time. I think that's always fun. In this case, it was Voyager. There's a really great song by a group called Mercy Me. Right now, it's called Dear Younger Me. And that song begins by saying, "Dear younger me, where do I start? If I could tell you everything that I have learned so far, then you could be one step ahead of all the painful memories still running through my head. I wonder how much different things would be, dear younger me. And I think that this is a an exploration I think that most adults go through at some time or another, perhaps multiple times through their life. I'm 45 years old, and you know, I've thought about this many, many times. If I could go back and change or do something different, what would I do? And it's always that kind of philosophical debate that I have with myself about my own existence and the course of my life. And so I find this episode just fascinating for that reason. And, you know, who doesn't love watching Seven of Nine, you know, march into the engine room and take Seska out? That was just downright cool. So,
and Janeway gets visited by the ghost of Chakotay Future.
Absolutely. So yeah, that was my completely shallow reason that Shattered was on my list as well. But again, I always love a good time travel episode. And you know, we talked about All the Bubbles, I believe was the name of the episode of Metatrex, where we kind of explored the idea of multiple timelines and you know, different universes and so on. But those are always fun episodes, and this was one in which, you know, these multiple timelines are converging right here on Voyager, and you got to kind of see the Voyager story in a capsule all its own, and that was fun.
We've got a real problem with time travel stories in general, that there's only so many ways you can tell them, right? You got the Back to the Future paradoxes, and you've got causal loops, and you've got all this, you know, there's kind of a small number of families of time travel stories. So it's a challenge. You can overuse time travel. It can be a plot device, a way out of any particular situation. It's kind of like Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. Oh, let's just go back in time and we'll solve the problem, right? You you can overuse it big time. And so this is an interesting fresh take on time travel in a way that doesn't seem to, it's not obvious that it invokes any kind of obvious, you know, sort of stereotypical time travel paradox. I mean, there is the paradox of Janeway learning a little bit about her future now, right? And that didn't seem to happen the first time around. So, but other than that, there's no real obvious paradox here. And it's certainly a different way of telling the story. So I just like seeing a fresh take on the time travel experience. You know, the metaphysics of time and the metaphysics of time travel is interesting. In fact, we keep promising to do an episode just on time and time travel. And we really need to circle around and do that on Metatrex one of these weeks. But this is a fresh take on time travel. So philosophically, if one of your goals is to try to flesh out all the different ways you can tell a time travel story and the different ways of tweaking with the concept of time or time travel, and you know, one of the advantages of telling stories like this is that it raises philosophical problems, right? The notion of a time travel paradox tells you that there might be a problem with the concept of time travel. If there's a logical problem with it, you can start to understand T'Pol's criticism of time travel, mm-hmm. right? She's skeptical of time travel, and so is the Vulcan Science Academy.
They've determined because, that it's impossible.
Yeah, but if part of the reason is that time travel paradoxes are illogical, then they just, by definition, can't exist. It's like saying 2 + 2 = 6, right? It just doesn't add up, so it can't be true. And so I think philosophically, the virtue of these kinds of stories, as entertaining as they are, is that the more different ways you can kind of tell the story, the more likely you are to expose whatever logical problems there are in the concepts involved. So I don't think you get a strong problem here that isn't explored elsewhere, but I like the attempt to provide a different take on time travel besides the same old paradoxes and the same old tropes that are used in time travel since the beginning of science fiction.
Yeah, I really have to give it up to Mike Sussman and Michael Taylor for coming up with a really unique and fresh way to tell a time travel story. So definitely hats off to both those guys. Well, Zachary, that actually completes our list. That was the last one on my list. I do have an honorable mention. That's Prophecy, Star Trek and Religion. I mean, it's always fun. We explored that topic in episode 8 of Metatrex. It's Turtles All the Way Down. Also, a great exploration of hermeneutics. And we've also discussed that in episode 19 of Metatrex, Suffer Horribly or Eat Fruit. So that was on my honorable mentions list. So that completes our lists.
I didn't have an honorable mention prepared, mainly because I was a little lazy and a little pressed for time as I was preparing for the episode today. But if I was going to have an honorable mention, I think Prophecy would be it. You know, it does explore the, you know, Star Trek and Religion have this kind of mixed relationship. You know, Star Trek generally takes this agnostic mm-hmm. approach. It's critical of religion generally. On the other hand, it does explore different races, spirituality, Bajorans and Klingons and whatnot, and paints them in various lights depending on the story at hand. And here's a case where you, I'm not sure exactly how to read Star Trek's take on religion in this particular episode. You know, these Klingons are backwater Klingons in a way. They're 80 years out of date.
They're very spiritual now, Klingons.
They're spiritual Klingons having a religious moment. And they, you know, they've certainly, they've encountered some new phenomenon. They're trying to mesh their new experience, you know, encountering Voyager and the fact that B'Elanna is pregnant. It aligns with these prophecies they believe, and they're trying to incorporate all of this into their worldview. So I like that you mentioned the hermeneutical problem, because any kind of new experience, if you have this kind of prophetic worldview that there's stuff that's been preordained based on, you know, spiritual texts or beliefs that you have, religious beliefs, you know, as new experiences unfold, you naturally, I think, want to try to incorporate those experiences into this worldview that you already have. And sometimes they don't match up very well. And you can see an attempt to kind of say, well, if we read the prophecy this way, then it all makes sense. And other Klingons going, that doesn't make sense at all. and it's comical in this episode, but these are the real kinds of discussions that religious believers since the dawn of time have had. Anyone with a prophetic worldview where there's some disagreement about what the exact meaning of a particular prophecy is going to be, is going to have this kind of discussion. Well, it might align with this, and this might fit with that. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of see this in the various way that different Christian denominations and individuals interpret the Book of Revelation, for example. All these prophecies and trying to match that up with political events and time frames and the different theories of interpreting it and whatnot. And here you can see Klingons doing the very same thing. Well, if we read the prophecy this way, then B'Elanna's baby is the Kubamach, right? if you read it the other way, then, you know, that's not true at all. And, you know, we just need to get out of the situation. Whatever it is, it's a fascinating look at you know, how Star Trek thinks of religion in general. But I love that these Klingons are just like 80 years out of date, backwater Klingons. Yes. Do you think that's supposed to be commentary on the nature of religion in general? That religion is something that in general is moved beyond in the 24th century, even for Klingons. That's an old school way of thinking, and these people are out of date by reading this prophecy so literally and so you know, applying it to everything they see around them, this new experience of encountering Voyager. Is that a criticism, or is that an exploration of Klingon spirituality in a positive sense? I'm not exactly sure in this episode.
Well, whether that was the intention or not, that's certainly my interpretation of the intent. I will say, though, that it would have been difficult to put current modern day Klingons, I mean, apart from just, you know, another wormhole or something superficial like that, they had to put a group of Klingons in the Delta Quadrant. So it makes sense as a storytelling element. But as far as, you know, my personal interpretation of it, I think it was somewhat of a commentary regarding, you know, the nature of religion, the idea that, you know, that these ideas are outdated. But I have to say that I really enjoy, when I go back and I watch this episode, the reaction, and it never gets old for me, the reaction of the Klingons to Tom in particular, because, you know, they're imagining that the, you know, the father of the Kubamak is going to be this great warrior. And, you know, it's Tom, you know, it's kind of Weasley Tom, you know. But, you know, for me personally, as a person of faith, it really causes me to think about my own preconceptions of Jesus as a real historical figure. You know, perhaps if I had the ability to travel through time and go back to, you know, 31 AD, I often wonder if I would even recognize him as a person, because, you know, I have my own preconceived notions. Some of them are colored by, you know, my reading and interpretation of scripture, but we all have our own notions of who God is or what God is like. And I think it's fascinating here when I see how the Klingons are reacting to Tom. You know, Myro very well could be the Kubla Mok. We never really get an answer to that question: is she or isn't she? So she very well could be the Kubla Mok who was prophesied to them. And so, you know, this problem that they have with Tom, he just didn't fit into their preconceived notions of who the Kubla Mok is. And, you know, I often wonder, you know, if I had an opportunity to see, you know, my own God, you know, in a real context, you know, would I recognize him? I think about, you know, the prophet Isaiah, who did his best to describe him. He described him as someone who wasn't particularly handsome. He was someone who was not comely. And so I think about, you know, modern art and how we interpret Jesus, God, in various art forms. And, you know, just... it's just an interesting exploration for me as a person of faith. So it raises some pretty great questions that, you know, I just don't get old for me.
Well, this isn't really a new question or a new observation about religious belief in general, but I think it's not obvious at all how much of ourselves we write into the things we believe.
Sure.
You know, you read a certain passage of scripture or a certain prophecy, if you're a believer in a particular faith, how much of that is popping out at the page at you, because it just is, the meaning is clear and it's obvious and unambiguous. How much of your personality and your own assumptions, your own worldview, you're reading into the text? So it really is this hermeneutical problem. There's a problem in sort of defining the meaning of a particular prophecy in this episode. How do we know whether the criteria for the Kubla Mok are met in this case, right? How do we know for sure that this is really the answer to this prophecy? But then there's the question of like the first person hermeneutical problem. How much of the text is speaking to me directly and unambiguously, and how much am I reading into it, and how much of my own expectations am I putting on this thing that I believe? And you know, again, I don't have the answers to any of that, but I think there's always the danger there with religious belief that you're reading things that aren't really there.
Well, Zachary, any final thoughts?
Well, I think my final thoughts are just about season 7 of Voyager in general. You know, like I said a few times, Voyager is my favorite Star Trek series. You know, the reasons I love watching Voyager aren't necessary for the philosophy in the episodes, despite the fact that, you know, we do this show on Star Trek and philosophy, and despite the fact that I'm a philosopher, you know, by temperament and by experience. I that's not all of who I am. And Voyager speaks to me in other ways besides philosophy. And despite that, there's a lot of philosophy going on. You know, I'm pleased that we pulled some good threads out of season 7 of Voyager, because generally season 7 is not my favorite season of Voyager. When I do rewatches, there's a couple of episodes that I really enjoy in season 7. Shatter, that I mentioned, is one of them. There are a few others, but I tend to kind of go gravitate towards seasons 3, 4, 5, and 6, you know, sprinkled with 1 and 2 here and there. And, you know, the meat of Voyager for me is not in season 7, but you know, the acting is well developed. You know, seeing the Doctor contained inside 7 of 9 is just brilliant. But philosophy, it's a little light. So I'm actually really looking forward to circling back around to Voyager in a few weeks when we get back to another round of Essential Trek Philosophy for Voyager and we pick up season 6. But in the meantime, I'm pleased we pulled out a bit more. You know, oftentimes when I watch these episodes, I like the Voyager family so much that I myself tend not to pay attention to the philosophy all the time, because I just get kind of caught up in the drama. I'm kind of like, remember that episode I think it's the episode when Voyager goes back in time to the 20th century, and I think you've got Neelix and you've got Kes, and they're watching soap operas.
Yeah,
and they're commenting on this, like, how can you just get, you know, watch the action without being involved? You know, we're used to holo novels, and Kes is saying, you kind of get caught up in the drama of it, you know, just sitting back and letting it soak in. Voyager's like that for me. I can just put it on, let it soak in the quality of it and the feel of it and the character interaction. I don't need to talk about philosophy and Voyager to get joy out of watching Voyager. But despite that, I think I surprised myself about some of the threads we found.
I was really surprised at how many episodes we matched on. But I was as equally surprised about the ones that we didn't. I think you're exactly right. Season 7 isn't the most philosophically rich season of Voyager that we got. In fact, you know, 4, 5, and 6, I think are all fairly rich. Season 7's kind of light, but like you said, I'm really surprised at the threads we were able to pull out. As always, Zachary, you know, it's my hope that our listeners will go back and as they're doing their 50th anniversary rewatches, maybe they'll look at these episodes in a different way, or perhaps even they'll look at Voyager as a whole in a different way. As you said, I think Voyager, for the most part, isn't exactly the series that is particularly rich with philosophy, but nevertheless, there are some really great philosophical threads. The writers definitely gave us some wonderful little nuggets for us to kind of feed our minds and debate these really interesting ideas with. So I hope our listeners will go back and really kind of see Voyager, and certainly Voyager Season 7, in a different light. And as I said at the top of today's episode, I really hope that our listeners will engage in conversation in the Babel Conference under our show thread and share their own picks for Essential Philosophy Voyager Season 7 and talk about what particular ideas kind of stood out to them. And let's keep that conversation going, and perhaps you'll agree with us on some of these, and maybe you'll call us out on a couple and say, oh, come on, I see this or I see that. We always enjoy being able to engage our listeners on the Babel Conference.
Yeah, I second that idea. I mean, in a way, you and I have done quite a few. We've done 30 episodes of MetaTreks now, or 30, 31. This is episode 32. And, you know, I hope we never get to the point where we've done this so much that it becomes routine and we stop surprising each other in the discussion. You know, we had some overlap, but we had some difference. I'm pleased to see that. But I really want to hear from our MetaTreks listeners in the Babel Conference or on Twitter or otherwise. We'll give you the contact information at the end of the show. I want to hear, from all of our listeners, you know, what did we miss? You know, what threads in season 7 of Voyager do you find most interesting? You know, what did we forget to talk about? What excites you philosophically that you know, we didn't do justice to here today? This is just the beginning of a conversation. We just picked an arbitrary number. We're going to pick 5 episodes each, and you know, we could have picked 6 each or 7 each, and we could have found a few more threads, and we just don't have time to talk about every single episode in an episode like this. So please take the time to find us, send us a comment, find us in the Babel Conference, and you know, join the discussion and keep the conversation alive. But in the meantime, this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week, so here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
You know, Star Trek All Access gives you a great acronym, though.
STAR!
STAR, yeah.
Yes.
STAR!
Yeah, the upward angle on the... Yeah, totally get it.
The Orb.
I don't know if obsessive love is really love, because it's I think it's more about possession. Yeah, and for Dukat, she's a possession of his, not really a relationship of his.
The 602 Club.
I loved that first volume, the 3-minute format. I was highly skeptical about it. Tartakovsky, I believe, was in Star Wars Insider. They had an interview with them where they were like, oh, this is bold, you know, 3 minutes. How did this come about? And I remember very specifically because I was stunned.
And introducing Stage 9, a podcast about the people who make Star Trek.
Had the story brewing in my head for a long time, but I eventually realized it was a beautiful fit for this project, and it turned out to be the right fit.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Pretty much anywhere you can get podcasts, you can find the Trek FM shows. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, You'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats in our content development team, and many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbital will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
You can also leave us a voicemail, look in the sidebar on the show page, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, our handle is just @trekfm.
You can also find us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/trekfm. And as we've mentioned several times in today's episode, the Babel Conference, you can type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field. That's our listeners-only discussion group. Or you can go to the website at trek.fm and click discussion in the menu bar.
We also invite you to leave a rating and a review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show, and it's one of the most important things you can do to help other listeners find the show. Well, Mike, when you are not riding the turbolift from time period to time period in the shattered Starship Theseus, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network these days?
Well, Zachary, I'm most active on Facebook, certainly around the Babel Conference, on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. And Zachary, when you're just going through the motions, doing your day-to-day mundane routine, when you were destined for greater things, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the network?
Well, likewise, the two best places to find me are in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group, and you can find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, Zachary Fruhling. That's @Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, and Fruhling, Fruhling. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from the network, specifically C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Reshing, and Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Will Wynn, our content manager, and Richard Marquez, our production manager. And we'd like to give a special thank you and a shout out to our two associate producers, Patrick Devlin. You can find Patrick on Twitter under the handle @MagicDrop5. And our newest associate producer, Kay Elizabeth Janeway, and you can find her under the handle @ChocoWeeble. We really want to thank both of our associate producers for their support of MetaTreks in particular, and especially their support of Trek.fm via Patreon. Well, everyone, thank you for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.